to the last case of the day, Marshall Perry v. Local 701, appeal number 083662. And for the appellant, Mr. Andre. Hello again. It seems like I saw you the other
day. Like a bad penny.
It's good to see you again.
May it please the court, counsel. First of all, I want to correct something. The record has previously said Marshall Perry. My client, who's actually sitting here, is Perry Marshall.
Sorry.
That was some misnomer, but it's not your fault. It was in the record all along. The first thing I suggest to the court, in analyzing this case, there should be a division made between what happened before August of 2002 and what happened afterwards. Because that's where a lot, I think, of the misapprehension and difficulty comes. Prior to August of 2002, my client had had difficulty with union representatives Ori, Lambert, and Ludwig, who didn't like the fact that he was outspoken, told him they didn't like the fact that he was outspoken, told him that they were going to get him, at one point told him, you're not bulletproof, and another time told him, don't question my authority, otherwise we're going to get you. Well, in August of 2002, they got him. In August of 2002, after a claim that he didn't show up to work at a place that he did show up to work, my client was removed from what they called a short call list. He was removed by management officials of the union. He received a telephone call from management officials of the union that told him, as quoted on page 12 of my brief and page 13, that they were removing him from the books. So my client was removed from the books by union officials, a combination of officials Ori, Ludwig, and Lambert, people who had expressed to my client they were going to get him because he was outspoken. After August of 2002, my client explored appeal procedures that he had to his being stricken from the list. One of those appeal procedures was an appeal committee composed of three persons, one selected by the union member, one selected by the union, and one that was a public person. But that was an appeal process. He had already been removed from the list. He also subsequently explored appeal to the International Union under provisions of the Constitution that existed there. But again, they were not the ones who made the decision whether he would be removed from the list. They were an appellate body who he could appeal to if, in fact, he was wrongly removed from the list. So the issue of the case really revolves around whether or not the initial decision in August of 2002 to remove my client from the list that was made by union officials, whether that was in violation of his rights under the LMRDA, the right not to be retaliated against for being outspoken. And we have proof, uncontested proof, frankly, that he was told that he was going to be punished for being outspoken. He was punished for being outspoken. So the issues involving the appeals committee, which we never included as a party to this because they were just that, an appeals committee, and the issue involving the International, which was included as a party along with some of their members because they're responsible for upholding the union constitution, which also provides he can't be retaliated against, is a separate issue from whether or not the original union officials, Orley, Lambert, Ludwig, retaliated against my client because of his outspokenness. Now, in summary judgment, the only issue is whether or not there are triable issues of fact. All inferences have to be drawn in favor of my client. And while I would concede to much of the arguments that were made by the district court judge in this case concerning the international, that they were not the party who retaliated against my client, the argument with regard to them is their ratification of the retaliatory actions on the part of the union. What I cannot agree with regard to the district court, however, is the fact that they lean so much on the appeals committee, which we never included as a party anyway, as somehow being the body that removed my client from this list. They were not the parties who removed him from the list. He was removed from the list based on a telephone conversation and records that we showed that said that I believe it was Mr. Lambert who called him and told him, you are removed from the list. So that's the actions that this caused this lawsuit to be filed in the first place. And we believe that on summary judgment principles, given the inferences that are required, that the action against the union particularly should never have been stricken based on summary judgment, and on Ludwig based on summary judgment. While there's some argument that could be made that if we were suing the appeals committee, it could be stricken. First of all, we haven't even included them as a party. They're not the party we're complaining about. And while there may even be some argument that the international was too remote based on the fact that the international was not in cahoots, so to speak, in the sense that they actually planned to have him removed from the list, the argument with regard to the international is simply that they ratified the retaliatory actions that were taken by the local. It wasn't because they hated my client. In fact, the record shows that Mr. Curley said he didn't recall my client. But the issue was that they allowed a retaliatory action to be taken based on the outspokenness of my client. For all those reasons, we feel that the decision on summary judgment was wrong, should be reversed and remanded, and I'd like to save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you. And Ms. Gunter?
My name is Sue Gunter, and I represent International Vice President Lawrence Curley in this case. I'm going to address two issues, the motions to strike and also the claim against my client, Vice President Curley. First of all, the district court correctly concluded that Mr. Marshall had not shown that he could establish a necessary element of his claim against Vice President Curley, and that namely being unlawful motivation. To make out his freedom of speech claim against Vice President Curley, Mr. Marshall had to show three things. He had to show that he had exercised his rights to free speech under the LMRDA, and then he had to show that Vice President Curley took some action against him in substantial part because of that exercise of free speech rights, and then he had to show some harm or injury. The only involvement that Vice President Curley had with Mr. Marshall consisted of two things. One was an exchange of letters between an attorney for Mr. Marshall and Vice President Curley, in which he tried to appeal a matter or a dispute under the collective bargaining agreement through the International Constitution's appeal procedures. And then also, Mr. Marshall had filed a series of internal union charges with Vice President Curley against various officials with the local union. In the exchange of letters, Vice President Curley, in accordance with a very long-standing policy of the IBEW, refused to handle that dispute under the collective bargaining agreement through the appeals procedures in the International Constitution. And that policy dates back to at least 1979 and through at least three international presidents. The collective bargaining agreement had set up the referral procedure that was at issue, established the procedures, the referral procedures, and also provided for a final and binding decision by this tripartite appeals committee of any disputes under that referral hall procedure, and that was simply the proper course for that particular dispute. With regard to the internal union charges, Vice President Curley assigned those charges to an international representative for an investigation. He investigated the charges and then made a report to the Vice President, finding that those charges had no merit. Vice President Curley testified that he reviewed that report and then dismissed the charges as having no merit. There was one additional charge that Vice President Curley received later that he dismissed as being untimely filed because it had not been filed within the time required by the international constitution. Well, to make out his freedom of speech claim against Vice President Curley, what Mr. Marshall had to do and which he failed to do was show some connection between these actions that Vice President Curley took and his alleged expression of free speech. And that is the missing element here. And there simply is, he presented absolutely no evidence of that. He, in his brief before this court, Mr. Marshall raises three factors that relate to this claim against Vice President Curley. First, he makes conclusory statements that he was treated differently than others, but both below and here, he points to no facts. He also makes a conclusory statement that Vice President Curley had conspired with the local 701 officials. There's no evidence of that. None was presented below. None is pointed to here. He also contends that the district court improperly struck submissions that he made on summary judgment that would have gone to causation. But none of the submissions that were struck go to causation show unlawful motive by Vice President Curley. He mentioned here that what he's claiming is that the international ratified the conduct. However, the action that Vice President Curley took can't be that ratification alone, if it was done for lawful reasons, the lawful reasons that he gave, and nothing else has been shown, that is not sufficient to overcome or make the showing that he was required to make under the LMRDA. I want to briefly mention the motions to strike, and the record clearly shows that there was no abuse of discretion in striking some of the submissions that Mr. Marshall made to the district court. The record clearly shows that the judge's opinion shows that she considered each request separately and ruled on each request separately. She denied some and granted some. He has conceded here on page 20 of his brief that all of the items that were struck as hearsay, as conclusory, as repetitious, were properly struck, leaving only the items that were struck for lack of foundation, for failure to provide copies of documents. And those are well supported in the case law. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Mr. McDowell.
Good morning. Stephen McDowell. I represent IBEW Local 701 and Art Ludwig with respect to this matter. I'd like to clear up, I think, a confusion that perhaps has been raised by Mr. Andrews' argument. If the court would turn its attention in its review of this case to page 20, footnote 13 of the district court's decision, the district court notes that there was paragraph number 68 of the party's 56.1 statements, which was proposed by Local 701 and which was admitted by the plaintiff, that stated that the records show that Mr. Marshall was not removed from the out-of-work list until after the appeals committee's decision. Basically, the appeals committee was the decision maker with respect to this case, so it was a bit surprising in oral argument to hear this, because at page 39 of our brief, we quote page 25 of Mr. Marshall's brief, which observes, while the appeals committee was the decision maker who imposed the sanction of removal from his position on the out-of-work list, the decision was based on inaccurate, false information submitted by union officials who were retaliating against plaintiff. So we were operating in this case from the position, which was established basically by concession in the district court, that it was the appeals committee, a tripartite body, rather than the union, which made the decision to remove Mr. Marshall from the out-of-work list. And as noted in paragraph 68 of the Rule 56.1 statements, the documentary records of Local 701 established that Mr. Marshall was not removed from his position on the out-of-work list until after the appeals committee's decision. And that then moves into our decision, which is based upon our position that's based on the Conan decision, that a decision made by an entity other than the union, such as a tripartite appeals committee, is not subject to challenge under the LMRDA as a union action. There may lie an action under the LMRA for a violation of the contract or something of that nature, but it's not a union action for purposes of the LMRDA, and that's the only statute that was relied upon by Mr. Marshall
Conan
in this case.
Conan is distinguishable factually, though, isn't it?
What? Excuse me?
Conan is distinguishable factually, isn't it?
Yes, Conan involved an employer as opposed
yes.
to a tripartite body.
But why isn't that important?
Well, the key point here is that the LMRDA addresses union action, not an entity other than the union. Just as the employer is not a union,
so that
similarly.
That made Conan an easy case.
What?
That made Conan a comparatively easy
yeah,
case.
Yeah, it was a bit easier than this case, but the key point of Conan is that the LMRDA is a statute that only regulates officers of unions and unions themselves as opposed to bodies other than
the union. Are you aware of any cases that closer to our facts that apply the rule that you're arguing for?
I didn't cite any in this court, and the only place where they may have been cited is in, since we did raise this issue, I believe, in four separate briefs in the district court, in the summary judgment brief, as well as in three motions to dismiss. The problem is, in relating back, I simply can't remember that issue, and because in this court, there was basically the Conan issue had been essentially waived in the district court. My approach was different, so I didn't go into that depth on the case. So I cannot, with definitive authority state that there is a specific case of that nature. But there are cases which hold essentially that tripartite bodies such as this are considered analogous to arbitrators, but I did not cite any in this brief, and so I don't feel it right to rely on them at this point. And so, in essence, the remaining arguments are primarily based upon our brief on the district court's decision, number one, that there was a failure to argue the Conan case, and therefore there was essentially an acquiescence with respect to that, with respect to the fact that basically this case does fit within Conan because it involves a body other than a union making the ultimate decision, the appeals committee. And then we would also note that there are two points with respect to Marshall's failure to establish a prima facie case with respect to causation, particularly the fact that Mr. Marshall never availed himself of the opportunities that the appeals committee gave him to explain the real, quote, emergency basis for his failure to report to work and actually work on the date of the involved case. So with that, we would ask that the district court's position and its decision on summary judgment be affirmed.
Thank you. And Mr. Andre. Three minutes.
To address Mr. McDowell's point first, on page 12 of our brief and 13, we refer to the plaintiff's statement of facts, paragraph 46. Plaintiff's statement of facts, paragraph 46, made this point. In a phone message the day after the incident, the plaintiff was advised, Perry, it's Ken Lambert. It is Thursday, the 29th of August, at about 3:52. Perry, after a temporary review of what happened, Jeff came back and told me. We went in and sat down and talked with Art. And after reviewing, it was my recommendation, along with Art's, that we were going to remove you from the books. So I am removing you from the books. So I am removing you from the books as of tonight. I just want to let you know so that you can get in here and sign, re-sign the book if you wish to do so. That's from our statement of facts at paragraph 46. That was before the district court. There was never a concession that he was not removed from the book by union officials. The only thing that happened was in the appeals process, the tripartite committee simply determined that they were not going to reverse the decision that was made by the union. There was never any concession made that the union did not remove him. Otherwise, that statement and the plaintiff's statements of fact would have made no sense. With regard to counsel for Curley's argument about the fact that some submissions we agreed with, we certainly did. Hearsay is certainly not allowable, and a lot of it was duplicative. It was, in fact, a layperson's affidavit. So I can't quarrel with those things. But the point that's critical here is that the tripartite committee, all that it did was simply approve what had already been done, and that was the removal. And the failure of the international to act simply, again, approved what had already been done by the union. For all those reasons, we feel that the decision of the district court should be reversed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you to both counsel, or all three counsel, I should say. And that case is under advisement as well, and we will recess until tomorrow.